The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 20% off during the month of September.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir.
We are now where we always should have been. In power, in the Liberal centre, in tune with the British people.
He's the Deputy Prime Minister. Come 2015, he wants to be the kingmaker. Again, with Labour, with the Tories, doesn't seem to matter. But is Labour ready to forgive and forget? We'll read the runes. And what about Labour? A YouGov poll says they're neck and neck with the Tories and behind with young voters. Has it come to this? How did it come to this? We'll try to explain. And as a primer for the aspiring politician, Paxman, Humphreys, Adam Bolton, how to deal with those questions from hell. Joining me for all of this, The Guardian's political columnist and party conference stalwart Michael White, our columnist Martin Kettle, and from the Policy Network, welcome to Patrick Diamond. Let's start in Glasgow, for there were some Labour gags, some personal history, and plenty of platitudes. But through it all, Nick Clegg's intent was clear, for the Lib Dems to remain a pivotal force in British politics, if only because of the weakness of the other main parties. Martin, you were there. The big announcement on school meals is getting a bit of a pasting this morning in the papers from the Tory press and from Tories generally, but what was your take on the Lib Dems' tour de force?
Pretty successful conference given where they are, I think it basically is. I mean, where they are is really bad, and we mustn't forget that.
So it could have been worse.
Well, not much. There was a poll earlier this week which said 4% of voters are definitely going to vote Liberal Democrat in 2015. That seems to me not really very good. The conference, I mean, the conference could not have gone better from Clegg's point of view. He asserted his authority. He won all the votes, and they had quite a lot of votes because in the Lib Dems they do that, unlike in most of the other conferences. And he has a position. His position is that the Lib Dems are the third party in British politics, and that come the next general election, there's likely to be a hung parliament. That's what he wants, and he's in business to do deals. I think you can read through what he said to make it fairly clear that he would prefer to do another deal with the Conservatives, but he's open for business with Labour too.
Mike, do they look like serious people? Do they look like kingmakers again?
They look like much more serious people than they used to. Clegg had a bit about that in his speech as well. He recalled, it was David Laws who said the first party conference he went to 1994 in Brighton, they voted to legalise dope and prostitution and brothels and get rid of the Queen and so on. He said, it was my first. I thought it was going to be the party's last. So, no, they are a party. Martin uses in his column today a good word. He said he's teaching them to become a party of pragmatists. And every year since the coalition, we've gone to this conference licking our lips, saying the grassroots won't put up with this, and they put up with it. And an old lag said to me, they love being in government, Michael. I'm amazed when you look back on the past, but they really like it. They've matured, and they have, except maturing sounds boring, and I found a lot of the debates quite interesting. There are enough smart people, the sort of SDP wing, you might say, if you want to be patronising, who can talk about aggregate demand and missile throw weights to make these debates worth concentrating on. Dare I say I enjoyed it?
If you feel you must.
It's always the most enjoyable conference of the three, in my experience. I've always, it's not the most important, but it's always a pleasant place to be.
Well,
he's saying it is the most important now, Martin. He's saying you two get your act together because I'm going to be there, and I think they're going to do better in the election because of differential turnouts and differential swings. These Lib Dems dig in. Paddy Ashton over a pint said, it's like Beaugest. Do you remember him in the old French Foreign Legion movies?
No, before you have my time.
You have four fortresses, and you defend them against the wily Tuareg, and that's his view of Lib Dems.
Let me bring in Patrick Diamond here, Michael, because there was talk about whether or not Clegg will be happier with Labour or continuing with the Tories. He seemed to be saying, I will do whatever the British people want me to do. But what do you think, Patrick? Do you think that Labour are looking at it that way? Would they be happy to deal with Clegg?
Well, I think that the relationship between Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband is not a particularly warm one. There are various personal reasons for that, perhaps, but also there's some underlying political reasons. I mean, one of them is that, of course, the Labour Party under Ed Miliband hopes to harvest votes on the centre-left, which they see the Liberal Democrats as having, as it were, abandoned by going into government with the Conservatives. I think it's also clear, and again, this comes out from Martin's column this morning, that the long-term goal that some people in both the Labour and Liberal Democrats have had historically of realigning British politics to create a new centre-left alliance between the parties now looks, if not in tatters, then certainly very questionable as a kind of long-term objective. So the sort of mood music between the parties is not close, the relations are not warm, and I think for that reason, the notion that Clegg is equidistant between Cameron and Miliband seems somewhat far-fetched to me. I think the reality is he would prefer to do business with the Conservatives, at least for the foreseeable future.
If they don't get on, personally, I don't take this whole thing down market, but the personalities are interesting. Why don't they get on?
Well, I wouldn't exactly know the reasons as to why they're not particularly close.
You don't expect these people to be best buddies anyway. I doubt that Cameron and Clegg were, but they've been able to work together.
Yeah, I have no insight into whether they are, as it were, personally friendly or whether their personal relations are warm or not. But I think, as I say, there are political reasons as to why, as leaders, there are a lot of tensions between them. I think it would also be true to say that probably in the instance of Syria, the position that the Labour front bench took and Ed Miliband's position as Labour leader probably did cause some antagonism both among the government on the Conservative side and among the Liberal Democrats. So that may be another reason as to why relations are perhaps not as warm as they could be over the recent period.
They're a lot better than they were. I mean, two, three years ago, they were absolutely terrible.
They've gone, relations, as you all know, in politics always go through ups and downs. And I think at the beginning of the coalition, there was, in a sense, a lot of shock and consternation within Labour ranks that the Liberals had had the temerity to go in with the Conservatives into coalition. I think that mood eased to some extent. And Martin's right that in 2011, 2012, there was some evidence that relations were beginning to thaw again between the parties. People were obviously looking ahead to the next election. As Michael's already said, it is very likely in 2015, because of the way the British electoral system works, that Labour will come out of that election with a significant number of seats, regardless of whether it's ahead in the popular vote in the election. And so for that reason, there has to be some expectation that Clegg will need to deal with Ed Miliband. But as I say, I don't think it will be on the basis of particularly warm or friendly relations. And I think more fundamentally, as Martin argues in the column today, it will not be on the basis of a notion of a kind of fundamental realignment of British politics around a progressive political project.
Mike, what do you think the grassroots think? Would they prefer Labour?
Oh, yes. No doubt about it. And Clegg was under pressure on the economy and on a fairer society. There was a glorious moment when a little old lady, well, careful, Mike, somebody a bit younger than me, got up to rostrum and said, the slogan is stronger economy, fairer society. How about stronger society, fairer economy? That sounds better to me. That makes me more comfortable. That's the mood of the grassroots. But, as we say, they kind of like being in government. And don't forget, these conferences are full of people who've run local councils. The woman who moved the official position on defence is a politics lecturer at Cambridge University. I spoke to her afterwards. She's also a Cambridge councillor, of course. The Lib Dems control both. And they sometimes, not in Cambridge, these people are in a coalition usually with the Tories. I agree with Patrick when he said that Clegg and Cameron on the front cover today of Private Eye with Vince Cable in the background are closer personally. They're the same height. Old Cameron could never have done that deal with Sarkozy, but it's not personal in politics. In fact, there was that nice Clegg anecdote where he says all three leaders were a bit sort of starstruck with Andy Murray at some reception, and old Murray, feeling a bit extrovert by the sound of it for him, said, why can't you three be friendly like this all the time? And mostly people get on more or less. There are no, Martin will correct me, no real hatreds, few real hatreds in politics.
The only real hatreds are inside your own party.
That's the one.
And of course, the political correspondence. Let's talk a bit more about Labour. And you talked about front covers. They're the front cover of Private Eye. On the front cover of The Spectator and The New Statesman, there are pictures of Ed Miliband. And in both cases, he's depicted as Wallace of Wallace and Gromit fame. And what they seem to be saying is that this is all going to be about Ed Miliband between now and 2015, that the questions will be about him personally. Patrick, do you think that's true?
Well, I think there is some concern about that in Labour ranks. People look back, of course, to the experience that Neil Kinnock had in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when, of course, he was relentlessly pursued by the tabloid press. And he was, in a sense, vilified, of course, not least by the Sun newspaper under the control of Mr. Rupert Murdoch. And I think that there's a fear that this will be replicated in the case of Ed Miliband. I have to say, I don't think that this is going to have really a very fundamental effect on Labour's political position. I mean, of course, these leadership issues are a factor in how people vote, but the real outcome will come down to more fundamental questions about whether Labour's trusted on the economy, whether it's seen to have, you know, a compelling policy agenda, and whether people trust the Labour team. But having said that, of course, there will be a debate about Ed Miliband's credibility or potential credibility as a Prime Minister, but I don't think we should overplay that too much.
Martin, he could do well with that spotlight of conference, or he could do even more badly than he has been doing recently. I think, see in the paper today, Peter Obon in The Telegraph seems to have flipped a bit. He says Ed Miliband's proving to be a brave and adroit leader. Is this a sign that Ed is maybe turning it round?
I think it's a bit premature for that. I think Patrick's being a little bit too complacent on this one, because I think there is an Ed Miliband question out there. I think there are basically going to be two questions in the general election from the Tories' point of view. One is, don't let the Labour back in the driving seat on the economy after they crashed the car, as they would put it. And the other is, can you imagine Ed Miliband as Prime Minister? And obviously the first is more important than the second for shifting votes, but the second you've got to have a good answer to in order to have confidence in Labour on the first. And so, you know, it is a difficulty. Each speech that he gives at a party conference is a big test. And, you know, last year he made what everybody thought was a rather good speech, but then didn't follow it up. So, I mean, as ever with party conferences, one looks for a good performance. But really what one's looking for from the Labour Party is a sustained, credible, alternative vision, which they believe in and which they can persuade people about.
The other point, though, on leadership that we should also consider is that, of course, all the three mainstream political party leaders are fairly distrusted by the British people at the present time. So David Cameron, Nick Clegg and Ed Miliband all have pretty negative ratings.
And that's unusual.
It is unusual. And I think
and
it
pretty
does,
unhealthy.
It is unhealthy.
It's the new
I think
usual.
It raises some big issues about the way that the political class is viewed in British society at the current time. What is interesting, of course, back to your Andy Murray point here, is that in some ways, I think for many voters, Nick Clegg, David Cameron and Ed Miliband look very similar in who they are, where they come from, their backgrounds, how they behave, their style of politics, the way that they learnt politics. I think that is an issue about the kind of diversity of our political class. The other issue, though, that I was just going to mention is that I think in relation to Ed Miliband's leadership position, Martin's right, of course, people will look at his prime ministerial credentials. But with Ed's position, he is trusted and is liked on some dimensions. He's seen as very caring, he's seen as very fair. What he has to improve is whether people would trust him, for example, to handle a major national crisis, an issue of war, an issue where the Prime Minister was required to behave in a very authoritative and decisive manner. So I don't think his position is irretrievable, but it's true he has got a lot of work to do.
Mike White, this week Ed Miliband's hired Patrick Hennessy, the political editor of the Sunday Telegraph, to come and be his media advisor, deputy head of communications. Had he been even wiser than that and hired you, what would you be saying to him?
Well, he wouldn't be wise to hiring me, all right. Paddy Hennessy, incidentally, is an old Etonian. Just a detail. Where were we? Now, I think that Ed does have a problem with the British electorate, and we can't pretend he doesn't. There is a problem on policy and credibility. There's a problem that it's a two-man band, and the other one is ballsy, and he's more negative than positive, I fear, and his legacy is, sorry to be blunt, but there aren't many new faces, and the reason why they want to drag the old Fartonians out of retirement is because they would add ballast to the Labour team. That said, both on the economy and on the electoral dynamics of what are going to be probably four-party politics, they've had that in Scotland and Wales for a long time, thanks to UKIP we're getting it in England, it is very hard and will be hard probably on election night, as in Germany, to know what's going to happen until it happens. And UKIP may do much more damage to the Tories, or then again, it might do a lot of damage to Labour. And the Lib Dems may do better or worse than we think. Ed Miliband could, despite all the doubts people express, end up as the leader of the biggest party, and he'll become Prime Minister, and Nick Clegg will just change the plate, change the curtains, and remain Deputy Prime Minister.
Martin, what will they do about the economy? Mike mentioned the economy there, and of course, with all the figures looking better, or being portrayed as better, isn't that a problem for Labour, because Labour's shtick up to now has been, look at what a mess they're making of the economy.
It is a problem for Labour. Labour's got to have a different story to tell. It's going to try and do that by trying to finesse this, by focusing on the cost of living questions and what used to be called the squeezed middle, and you know the way in which the recovery is not a shared recovery, but a recovery in particular parts of the class system and in different parts of the country geographically. And that's a very powerful point, and it will, you know, if people are listening, it's a serious point. Labour will have lots of, you know, decent, serious caveats about the question of economic recovery, and you only have to look at the situation in the United States in the last couple of days to see that even there's a fragility about the economy. So, you know, intellectually, that's correct. The problem is, as soon, you know, once you've got the sense that there's a recovery, once there is optimism, economic optimism around, and there is now pretty clear evidence of economic optimism, once you've got that, once you've got the housing market beginning to rise in the Southeast, you know, where all the people who write about these things live, everybody talks a better game than reality on the ground may be.
Yes.
But that's very powerful. Very, very powerful. The medium is the message.
Patrick, how much policy do you want to see? Not just economic policy, but many people complain that Labour's approach so far has been fairly policy light. Is now the time to start rolling out policy?
Well, I have an unhealthy interest in policy, so I wouldn't take my view as in any way authoritative on that question. But I think Labour does need to show more policy detail. People want to know, how would it actually govern? And also, does it have an answer to some of the difficult questions that the issues that it's raising pose? So on this issue of living standards, which Martin refers to, it's true that Labour needs to have a living standards agenda which addresses the fact that the economic recovery is likely to be very imbalanced and not to benefit all groups fairly. But how you actually produce the policies that really deal with unequal living standards is much more difficult. Just to give you one concrete example, Ed Miliband has talked a lot about keeping down people's fuel bills, which, of course, have been a real cause of living standards decline in the last few years. But at the same time, he also has a very strong commitment to a kind of green energy agenda, which is likely, at least in the short to medium term, to lead to people's energy bills rising. So how does he reconcile his wish to make consumers better off in terms of their fuel bills with the fact that he also has a green energy agenda? And I think in lots of different parts of the Labour policy prospectus, you can see these kinds of potential inconsistencies emerging. So I think Labour does have a lot of work to do in terms of clarifying its message and really demonstrating to the British people that it has a credible policy agenda.
Mike White, if the problem for Labour is the leader, basically, should we see less of him and more of the others? And if so, who are the others?
Well, that was the point I addressed a moment ago. There aren't enough others yet. Rachel Reeves has become famous in the last week, thanks to Newsnight, for the entirely wrong reasons, although I think Rachel Reeves is a good thing.
I think she's really interesting.
Yeah, but you struggle. I never quite feel that Yvette Cooper, I rarely feel that she is a good retail politician in a way that would fit the bill. I occasionally try to imagine her as Barbara Castle, but succeed rarely. And you go through the card, and it's the same problem. All you've got is that powerful, compelling figure, Ed Balls, but he is very much a mixed blessing. And that's a problem which isn't easily resolved, won't go away. It's an enormous burden in the television age, lies on the leader. And, you know, we all like Ed Miliband. He's a good man, etc., and a smart man, a decent man. But, you know, does he cut the mustard with the voters? I'm afraid I'm yet to be persuaded, and time is running out.
Well, you can keep tabs on how Ed Miliband does and how Labour do at their conference in Brighton. You can follow that on our website. That's theguardian.com/politics. Let's look abroad now, for if recent years have been unkind to incumbents in European elections, that trend looks likely to be bucked next week by the continent's most powerful leader. German Chancellor Angela Merkel looks like she's going to stay in power. But as they say, there's many a slip between cup and lip. Martin, you've been following this. Could she fall?
I think it's very unlikely. It's possible to be a different coalition. See previous conversation we were having earlier in Germany, because under Germany's electoral system, you know, her coalition partner may not get enough votes to get into the Bundestag. That would mean she'd have to seek a different coalition partner. There are a number of unpredictable elements in it, and as Mike said about the British general election in 2015, this German general election in 2013, we won't know what what's going to happen until we know what the result is, because of the way that their system operates. But the big picture is that Merkel dominates German politics, and one way or another, she's going to emerge out of all this as a re-elected three-term chancellor, which is unusual in any political system and extraordinarily unusual in a time of economic crisis such as the one that she's been governing through. Now, she's done that by great pragmatism, sometimes, you know, squealing of brakes, U-turns, as for instance on nuclear power. But basically, she is a very adept modern politician who adapts to circumstances with great skill. The big question now is, has she got a bigger vision if and when she is re-elected to get some direction into the Eurozone and into the reform of the European Union? Just one final point. I mean, I think from the point of view of anyone who is sympathetic to the European Union in Britain, you should very much want Merkel to re-emerge as the leader in Germany, because I think she could play a very important part if and when there's a referendum here.
Patrick, are there things that we could learn from her in terms of her approach? She seems to be popular. She seems to have found a way to keep herself in tune with the German people.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Angela Merkel is that she seems to be running in the election nominally as the leader of the CDU, but actually as the biggest social democratic politician in Germany. I mean, she's proposing, you know, a national minimum wage for the first time. She's arguing for rent controls in the housing sector. Her approach to Europe, as Martin said, and the management of the euro, I think would be consistent with what a lot of social democrats would want to see happen. So I think in that sense, what she has very effectively done is to kind of blur the traditional ideological dividing lines in German politics and probably make it very difficult for many social democratic voters to see a very discernible difference between the two parties. And that seems to be the basis of her success. I think it's true that, as Martin said, though, that there are really big outstanding issues that she'll have to deal with if, as we expect, she's re-elected, not least on the question of the euro, how to deal with the banks, which remain really fragile across many parts of the European Union, how to deal, of course, with the periphery southern Mediterranean countries, which also are in a very unstable situation. And so I think people, if we're not going to go back, lurch into another Eurozone crisis, are going to expect from Angela Merkel some really decisive decisions in the next few months.
Mike White in Whitehall, are they rooting for her? Do you think that she's
no,
their best option?
They're far too well-bred to root publicly. She's the far and away the biggest politician in Europe. You look around all our countries, France is poor leadership and weak, Italy, say no more. Britain, well, it's self-excluded itself and it has an uncertain immediate future. No, Merkel's the man, and one way or another she's going to be a chancellor again, either with the existing coalition or presumably, as somebody said, with the SDP. But the question of German public's attitude towards being Mr. Bailout in the Europe, and whether or not they're willing to accommodate us. They will accommodate David Cameron a bit because they need Britain in to offset those soft southerners. But, you know, Slovenia, on some accounts, has got a banking crisis which will be solved as soon as Mrs. Merkel is re-elected. But re-elected she will be because she's gaining ground in East Germany where the left is strong. Traditionally, it's a remnant of the old Communist Party or an outgrowth. And she's, as Patrick said again, played to the social democratic centre, and that's put Steinbrück, her chief opponent, in a very difficult place. Not that he doesn't put himself in a difficult place all the time when given half a chance.
At an important election, probably won't receive the coverage it should do, but if you do want to keep up, you can follow it on our website, theguardian.com. Finally, a strange intervention, you might think. In an otherwise quiet week, the Prime Minister found himself entangled in the debate around whether football fans should be able to call themselves Yid. The word, offensive to many Jews, is one that Tottenham Hotspur fans say they've reclaimed in solidarity with the Jewish section of their supporters. An argument endorsed this week by David Cameron, despite the concerns of the football authorities and assorted campaigners. Martin, it just seemed that this question, it was raised by the Jewish Chronicle doing an interview with David Cameron, and hats off to them for pushing it and getting the story, but it does seem a strange thing for the Prime Minister to get involved in.
But Prime Ministers often get you know, changing your sport, a difficult ball bowled to them. That's one question. And the other is, prime ministers nowadays like to be seen to know about football. This is one of the curses of modern British politics. It doesn't apply in most other countries, but it's one of the legacies of Tony Blair, one of the many legacies of Tony Blair, and this one's particularly baleful, and Cameron's got himself entangled in it. On the substantive issue, I think he's completely wrong. I'm a season ticket holder at Tottenham, and I don't think that the chanting is acceptable. It just has to. They should find a sensible way of trying to make it diminish. Football has to deal with racism. It's a real problem on the terraces, or as they used to be called. And you know, you can't duck that. And if you allow. If you allow Tottenham fans to do this, then other things will follow, which we know only too well, and we can't go down that road.
Patrick, you've advised politicians in the past. Let's broaden it a bit. I mean, what do they do when they're cornered by the no-win question, the question that is put to them, and they know that no good will come of it? Do they just not answer it? Do they dissemble?
I think in this instance, it would definitely have been preferable either not to answer it or dissemble. I wouldn't put the tendency of prime ministers to engage in this kind of populist, you know, sort of style of engagement maybe so much to Tony Blair, although I agree he engaged in it. I think you could date it back as far as Harold Wilson, who of course loved to pose with his pipe and his HP sauce and all the rest of it.
He had a picture of the Huddersfield Town Cup winning team of 1930-something in his wallet.
He always Gladstone was a Shrewsbury Town fan, okay?
Well, that's even further back, Mike, because only, I'm afraid I couldn't go that far back in my
memory.
So I think that there has been, as Martin said, this tendency of prime ministers to try and leap on these sorts of media stories in order to curry favour with the public. It's never a good place to go. I think it was unfortunate that Cameron did it in this instance, particularly given the sorts of positions he's taking on other issues. Yeah. When you have Linton Crosby as your election strategist, and when you have taken that kind of approach to illegal immigration that they have with the poster vans and all the rest of it, I definitely would not be going near an issue like this in the way that he has.
So go on then. If he'd had the earpiece in and you'd been on the other end advising him, what would you have said when that question was put to him?
Leave the room.
Just feign a heart attack. I would don't answer it.
I would plead an urgent call from President Obama.
Mike, that question, that one that you know is just going to do no good, what would you say politician should do?
As other, I think you'd probably duck it. I'm notoriously, what's the word, regressive in language. The Guardian had a debate recently where there's a provisional ruling that pygmy is unacceptable nowadays, which makes me weep. But I wouldn't use a word like yid anymore because of its connotations from the brutal past any more than I'd use some of the other suspects, queer, the N word. You just don't do it. So I'm genuinely surprised. But the football tribe is, you know, it baffles me what happens. So my instinct is A, that he shouldn't have done it, B, that he was wrong, but C, that I might be talking complete nonsense.
So when the question is about football, they just can't help themselves. And we here have many questions. Some of them are real stinkers too, but that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Martin Kettle, Mike White and Patrick Diamond. The producer of Politics Weekly was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 20% off in September by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code Guardian.